Targaryen must understand this to be king. Or queen. I'm sorry, Rhaenyra. I have wasted the years since you were born, wanting for a son.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. I'm David Chen, and I haven't read Fire and Blood, the book on which House of the Dragon is based.
And I'm Kim Renfro, and I have read Fire and Blood, the book upon which the House of the Dragon is based.
Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. It's Thrones time again, Kim. It's Thrones time again. And there is a new show set in the Game of Thrones universe airing on HBO. It's very exciting. We are watching it and then recapping every episode for you. We're spoiling every episode for you, but we are not talking about anything from future episodes that includes anything in the books or anything on the next time on preview. This week, we'll be discussing season one, episode one of House of the Dragon, The Heirs of the Dragon, directed by Miguel Sapochnik and written by Ryan Condal. And it's an exciting time. Before we get to the podcast, a couple of announcements. I think there's probably going to be a lot of people tuning into this episode that haven't been listening to the podcast for a really long time. And if that's you, I want to start by saying welcome to the podcast. I'm, of course, David Chen. I'm really excited to be here with my brand new co-host, the author of The Unofficial Guide to Game of Thrones, Kim Renfro. And I'm really excited about the insights that we're going to be able to bring to you this season on A Cast of Kings. It's going to be a lot of fun. I do want to also say that in the past, we've had people support the show via various means, Kickstarter and so on. This year, there's a very easy way to support the show. And you got to go over to decodingtv.com, sign up for a membership there. And if you do that, you're going to get access to ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, as well as exclusive bonuses that Kim Renfro and I will be recording specifically for you. This week is the last week you're going to be able to listen to this podcast without any ads. Starting next week, turning the ads on, it's going to help us recoup some of our costs. But really, it's the people at decodingtv.com that are going to be helping to make this podcast possible. So please sign up for a membership at decodingtv.com and support A Cast of Kings. We'd really appreciate it. We'll put links in the show notes. All right, Kim. Before we talk about this episode, season one, episode one, The Heirs of the Dragon, let's talk about some of the meta stuff around the episode. Some of the stuff that doesn't have to do with the episode itself, but that might be surrounding the episode. So first of all, I watched the episode live, basically, quote unquote, as it aired last night on HBO Max. I'm curious, like, I know you saw it in advance. Did you also watch it on HBO Max, or did you just kind of use your advance copies?
I mean, most of my articles were all written using my press screener access, but I have to wait until the actual episode is up in order to get good things like specific screenshots of the moments that I want to write about, or like I always like to make at least one GIF from all the episodes. So I did click into it right around the time that it loaded up on the site on my desktop computer.
So there were some reports, apparently in the hundreds or thousands of people, their HBO Max apps crashed last night. Did you have any issues on that front? I'm curious.
I did not. The only thing that I thought was a little interesting was that like the episode title just wasn't there, and it wasn't there until this morning when I checked.
This morning, I checked. We have very meticulous show notes that Kim has prepared, and and there was no episode title until literally moments before we started recording this episode. So, no episode title. I will say that it worked fine. There were a couple of hiccups, and I had a very nightmarish scenario earlier this week. I think it was earlier this week, where my AMC Plus app logged me out of the AMC Plus app and then refused to let me back in because too many people were trying to watch the series finale of Better Call Saul at the same time. And so that was very bad. And I was like worried that it was going to be another repeat of this because basically we started watching House of the Dragon. And then when I logged into the HBO app, usually it presents you with the different profiles, like David Chen and like other people in your house. Well, it didn't have any profiles when I logged in yesterday. It was like just profile. I was like, oh no, is this another repeat of the AMC plus debacle. But I logged in with profile and then it kind of started a little bit, and then I was eventually able to like get in and it was okay. The app also like froze up halfway through the episode and I had to like restart it and then it was fine.
Oh.
So overall it was a fine experience, but I do want to acknowledge that this was a situation where probably HBO Max as an app had the most traffic it's had possibly since launch. And it did cause a handful of isolated issues. So hopefully you were able to watch it with no problems, but there were some reports of challenges. Second thing I want to bring up when it comes to a meta conversation is there was an HBO promo, and I hadn't seen an HBO promo in a long time. You know, one of those things where they like lay out what is going to happen for the next year. And often a network like HBO will use a high profile debut of a show like House of the Dragon to be like, here's what's coming up on HBO for the next year. And
yeah,
because for the other shows, you know, like Westworld or whatever, they'll show like one show. And it's like, here's one show that's coming out next year. But for something super high profile, they're like, we need to put our best foot forward. And HBO and the marketing team that was behind this promo, at least, I don't know if they're still there because there's been tons of layoffs and such. But
true.
HBO, in its heyday, and to this day, makes the best promos, in my opinion. They get you really excited about what's coming up. And I'm like, ooh, I'm excited about most of that stuff. We got our first glimpse of The Last of Us, which mm-hmm. is a really exciting show based on the video game.
With two Game of Thrones alumni.
Yes.
Starring in it.
Yes, Pedro Pascal and the woman who plays Lyanna Mormont, right? Or the girl yeah. who plays Lyanna Mormont. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Idol. Another show that looks really interesting. Anyway, I just thought it was really well put together and it got me excited about subscribing to HBO Max, despite the fact that there's been massive turmoil and mistreatment of creatives over at that network.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if you enjoyed the HBO promo that came out last night.
I did. Part of me is wondering if I'm like desensitized to those things because I get HBO promotional material thrown at me relatively frequently. But it was a solid one. I also just like in general yesterday, and I would say over the past like week or two, I'm seeing ads for House of the Dragon everywhere, like
yeah.
on Reddit, on TikTok, on YouTube, on like basically every sort of like pre-roll ad space that they could have like plugged the show on. It feels like they really went all out. And so I think they know that they have a lot of potential with this series on their hands
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very cool. Same experience. I'm seeing social ads all the time and pre-rolls and stuff like that. So, but anyway, loved the new HBO promo. And there was like a short one on before House of the Dragon and then a longer one they posted online. And the long one really gave special attention to The Last of Us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited. Craig Mazin, who did Chernobyl, it's based off of one of my favorite video games of all time. So I'm psyched about that. Final meta topic I wanted to get into before we get into the episode itself, which is don't Google any of the character names from the show. Don't Google any of the character names from the show.
Dave, what happened to you last night?
Oh, I don't know. Trying to be a good podcaster / colleague to Kim Renfro. And I want to make sure I know my shit. You know, I want to make sure all of my stuff is in order.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, oh, I gotta find out some background on some of these characters in the show. Well, you Google it and immediately, like literally first line of the description of, you know, whatever character, it tells you whether or not they lived or died and how they died, if they died.
Great.
And I'm just like, oh, that's very disappointing.
I spoiled the Red Wedding for myself by doing that when I was reading the books. So yes, excellent advice. Do not Google the character names until you have consumed all of the material that you want.
Yes.
Spoiler free.
And basically, if you want to understand who the characters are or what's going on in the show, your best resource is going to be A Cast of Kings. Don't Google. Come to A Cast of Kings. We care about spoilers. We're not going to spoil mm-hmm. anything from the future.
Mm-hmm.
This is the podcast where you want to get it done. I should point out, by the way, of course, that you can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com and email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. We'll also be reading comments about each episode from decodingtv.com on air. So you can sign up there and be part of the community. And we're also on YouTube and TikTok. acastofkings.com/YouTube and acastofkings.com/TikTok. there is going to be a lot of cool stuff on those channels. So this is, you're in the best place. You don't need the Googles. You don't need the Yahoos. You don't need the Bings. It's got to be a Cast of Kings.
Don't ask Jeeves a single thing.
Do not ask Jeeves about this show. Okay. I trust you. He will not have the answers you seek, or he'll have too many answers. Probably. So, all right. I'm David Chen. I'm speaking with Kim Renfro, author of The Unofficial Guide to Game of Thrones, and you're listening to A Cast of Kings. Let's talk about episode one of House of the Dragon. This episode's entitled The Heirs of the Dragon. And Kim Renfro, let's start by talking about overall thoughts on the episode, and then we'll walk through the episode scene by scene and talk about all the different things that you may have caught, may have missed. What did you think overall of House of the Dragon episode one?
I really liked it, especially as a starting point for this series. I think that TV pilots are very tough to nail. Like, you have a lot that you're trying to achieve with a series pilot, of like establishing the world, establishing the characters, setting up all the dynamics that are going to come into play in the future. And like Game of Thrones, I think Fire and Blood just has so many characters. And so I was curious to see how they were going to sort of like divide and conquer all of those different storylines. And I think that they did a really solid job of like letting you get to know the kind of core cast of characters that you're going to be watching, knowing like their motivations, and then getting a little bit of like the action and drama and violence and gore that is part and parcel with this HBO universe.
I'll share a couple of my thoughts. Overall, I thought it was like a very strong opening. I think one of the great things about Game of Thrones was seeing just the production values, right? Mm-hmm. Seeing all the sets they built, seeing the dragons and the CG, seeing the jousting in the case of this episode, like all this cool stuff. I remember watching The Last Duel by Ridley Scott, a movie that cost around $100 million. And there is a duel in that movie. Spoiler. Mm-hmm.
Is it the last one?
And the duel is incredible in that movie, but it's like, production value wise, it's like quite comparable to what you see in this episode. Like, just like, I'm watching these knights joust. I'm like, this is incredible, like what we're seeing, you know, just from a production value perspective. And so you're seeing craftspeople at the top of their game doing amazing work. And like, that itself is really amazing. We're back in this world that for many of us has a lot of emotions associated with it, a lot of thrills, a lot of disappointments. And so that's undeniably exciting. And I think overall the episode does a good job of setting up these characters and the main conflict that's going to take place over the course of this season, which is the line of succession for Viserys Targaryen.
Yeah, I think that to your point about like the world building and the emotions that they knew people were going to have carried into the show, I think they did a good job of like using some feelings that you might get from seeing a Targaryen flying on a dragon back, or from seeing the Red Keep again in like it, all of its glory and stuff. And I think that they did that really well while like giving you something more to be excited about. Yeah.
On the flip side, I think there were some challenges I had with the episode, right? Number one, there didn't really seem to be a main character in the episode. And with Game of Thrones, we were introduced to like a bunch of, like Game of Thrones episode one, we were introduced to like all these different houses and so on. But it really felt like the main character was Ned Stark, played by Sean Bean, right? Like he's the person we're going to be staying with for what we thought was the whole show. And then, you know, but it was like structured in that way. Like he's the good guy. He has a tough task ahead of him. Like, and here we focus a little bit on Rhaenyra's character played by Millie Alcock for the first part of it. Then we stick with basically like Viserys and his brother
Daemon,
for the rest of the episode. And so I felt like, oh, I don't really know who we're like with. And there's just a dizzying number of characters and plot lines and so on to keep track of. And so we're going to try to do our best to help you out with that. But like, just as a viewer, it was just a lot to keep track of. And so so I do think that did inhibit my enjoyment a little. I couldn't just kind of sit back and enjoy it. I'd be like, okay, who is this? And like, what's their relationship to each other and so on. So I would say solid start, definitely intrigued, definitely want to keep watching, very excited about the rest of the season, but also like this episode was a little bit scattered in terms of needing to introduce all these people in my perspective, and not having a strong kind of central character to be around, in my opinion. So
yeah,
or not having a strong central character, but like it didn't pick one for the course of this episode, I thought.
Yeah, they really kind of tried to balance you across.
Yeah,
at least four, like, pretty pivotal characters.
That said, I think the casting is awesome for the show, and I thought, like, specifically Millie Alcock, who plays Rhaenyra, Patty Considine, who plays Viserys, and Matt Smith, who plays Daemon, were all excellent. Like, it's like I find them very compelling. I can't wait to see where these storylines go. So, all right, let's dive into the episode now. Right off the bat, Kim Renfro, I know that this is going to be fairly confusing to follow because it starts with a voiceover, which is something that I think Game of Thrones has very rarely used, if ever, right? And certainly not in this way. Like, it's never been like, we're just going to straight up explain things to you.
Yep.
I think there might have been voiceovers in the past where you see someone voiceover like a montage or something, and then like...
It cuts to them actually talking
or something. But like, this is like, we just need to freaking explain to you what is going on, because it's actually pretty complicated, right?
Yep.
So there is a voice who we learn is Viserys's daughter. We don't know for a fact if it's Rhaenyra. It's heavily implied to be Rhaenyra, I think, based on how the show is edited and structured. But it's Viserys's daughter. And basically, do you want to explain to us what happened in this opening scene, Ken?
Yeah. So like you said, they're having to do a little bit of exposition right out of the gate to sort of like set the stage for what you're about to watch. And so we have this voiceover explaining to us that King Jaehaerys, who was the king prior to Viserys, that he is in decline and basically didn't have any heirs and therefore needed to call a great council in order to try and select an heir, because he wanted to ensure that succession wouldn't be something that became an infighting battle between Targaryens after his death.
Right. So he is a Targaryen, and the Targaryens have ruled for quite a while. They have 10 dragons at their disposal. It is a time of peace and prosperity. And so he wants to make sure it stays that way, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. They say that he had ruled for like 60 years of peace, which is an extraordinarily long time, given what we know about the volatility of Westeros in its later years. They tell us that this is the year 101. It's 101 AC, which stands for like after the conquest, which is Aegon's conquest. That's how like Maester started tracking time, was from the day that Aegon the Conqueror was anointed under the Faith of the Seven in King's Landing. And so they explain that there were several potential nominees for successor, but really the two primary choices were Rhaenys, who was King Jaehaerys's... Oh my God, now I'm like, wait.
I think it is his granddaughter, right? Because his eldest sons died. So
yes.
His granddaughter is Rhaenys, right?
Yes. So they
the
start
queen
as...
that never was, basically, right?
Right. So they let us know that there are several potential successors to the throne, but really the two primary options are two of Jaehaerys' grandchildren.
Yes.
Which is Rhaenys or Viserys, both grandchildren from different sons of Jaehaerys. So Viserys' father was Baelon, and Rhaenys' father was Aemon, who was the firstborn son of Jaehaerys. So Rhaenys, who's played by Eve Best, she's like the older woman with sort of like the beehive hairstyle in her silvery blonde Targaryen-ness. She was more of like the direct line, because Jaehaerys had, it's basically the firstborn male heir is supposed to inherit the Iron Throne. So Rhaenys was the daughter of Jaehaerys's firstborn son. So that's why some people think that she had the stronger claim, because she is directly of his primary line, whereas Viserys was his second son's child. Both of those heirs had died under unfortunate circumstances, and we were left here. And so, as we know from this exposition, Viserys was chosen primarily because too many of the lords of Westeros believed that a woman should never inherit the Iron Throne. So it was passed on to Viserys. And at the time, he was already married to Emma, And as we see in that sort of like opening scene, she's very pregnant at the time that he was finally named heir.
Presumably pregnant with Rhaenyra, who's played by Millie Alcock, who we meet later in the episode, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Other thing to point out is that this whole scene, this opening scene, takes place in Harrenhal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what's cool about House of the Dragon is you're seeing locations from Game of Thrones in a different state than you saw them in Game of Thrones. So Game of Thrones, we saw Harrenhal. I think it was that the place where the prisoners were being tortured?
Yeah, right, where Arya and Tywin Lannister have like all of their little conversations and everything. That's all taking place in Harrenhal in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, so here it's being used for basically like the equivalent of a coronation of sorts and or announcement of succession. And, you know, in the future, during wartime, it will be a place where people are brutally tortured. So sunrise, sunset, Kim, you know, things change over time. Okay.
It's true.
Then I don't know about you, but I was really amped for what they were going to do for an opening title sequence. And there was no opening title sequence. Now, to be fair, Game of Thrones had one of the greatest opening title sequences of all time.
True. It's a high bar.
High bar. Now, I read on Vulture this morning that there is going to be a opening title sequence. We just didn't see it in the first episode. So I'm curious what the next episode is going to be from an opening title sequence perspective. In this episode, we just see the Targaryen insignia in gold on a black background coming towards the screen, I think, and you hear this really badass music, and that's it. That's the whole thing. So I was disappointed there was no opening title sequence in episode one, but hopefully there will be one, and I'm very curious what it will be. So
I kind of liked it. By doing like voiceover and this sort of like exposition-y recap, it honestly reminded me of like the approach that other high fantasy like adaptations take, like Lord of the Rings. It gave me big like Fellowship of the Ring, Kate Blanchett as Galadriel is like explaining the history of this world, and then there's just like a quiet shot of like a sigil, and then everything. I think it made sense to not like break that exposition with like a big extended title sequence, but instead like let you sink in to understanding that yes, this is connected to Game of Thrones. No, it's not the same. And then boom, Rhaenyra flying on a dragon, give you all the Daenerys Targaryen feelings again.
I am very curious about this opening sequence, to be honest with you. Was it necessary is my question. You know what I'm saying? Like, imagine if we just started with Millie Alcock flying on the dragon, you know, like, and then they like, I don't know that I'm trying to think like, was it necessary to like have all that exposition? Like, or why would the showrunners have thought it was important for me to know all that, I guess, you know? And I guess like part of it is about that line, like line of succession questions have been an issue throughout history. Right. And it kind of helps you understand the relationships between the people. But that's what I was thinking throughout is like, it's notable that they use voiceover to explain this. So it must've been like really, they're like, we need the audience to get all this and it's really complicated. So let's just do it in voiceover, which like they generally don't do. So I'm just kind of like wondering throughout the whole thing, I'm wondering like why they made this decision and, you know, we may touch upon it again. Also, we see a text come up on the screen that says this is the ninth year of King Viserys Targaryen's reign, 172 years before the death of Mad King Aerys and the birth of his daughter, Princess Daenerys Targaryen. And then like the text fades out and you only see 172 years before Daenerys Targaryen. And it's like, remember, it's before the thing that you know, right? Like this is the thing that you know, just in case, like it's the thing you know, which I thought was both artful and also like very on the nose. It's probably effective. It's like, oh, it's the thing, you know, I'm watching. I'm like, it's the thing before the thing. Yes, that's right. Okay. Anyway, we open with a pretty awesome shot of the dragon flying overhead. Like we're in the clouds and then there's a dragon and it's flying overhead. And it's a great shot. And we see King's Landing again. And you had some thoughts on like how this scene played out, right?
Yeah. So Miguel Sapochnik, who we know directed this episode, also directed season 8, episode 5, The Bells, which was the big battle at King's Landing, which ultimately shows Daenerys making the choice to like just massacre all the people in that city and generally destroy a lot of things. And so I thought it was really clever that Sapochnik for this episode, like, basically framed all of the dragon flying scenes over the city in very similar ways to shots in that episode that kind of give us a very clear understanding that the people of King's Landing have a completely different relationship to the idea of dragons and dragon riders in this period of time for House of the Dragon. Like, nobody even looks up, really. It's as if, like, dragons flying overhead is just pretty part and parcel, and it's nothing to be afraid of. Whereas by the time that we got to Dany arriving to King's Landing with her dragons in Game of Thrones, like, it was, everyone knew that she was basically riding on top of, like, a weapon of mass destruction, and like the idea of that dragon flying overhead was a direct threat and terror, and we saw all of like the awfulness that comes from dragon fire. And so I don't know, it's reminding us that eventually, yes, the Targaryens are going to be decimated to the point that their last living rulers want to kill each other, slash Jon Snow eventually murders Dany as a result of what she did in the sack of King's Landing.
Happy memories. Happy memories.
Fun times.
So Millie Alcock, of course, again, plays Rhaenyra. And I'm going to like repeat some of these names and castings because I just want to, I hope it is helpful to do that. But she is Viserys' daughter. She lands in the fully functional dragon pit. We saw kind of the ruins of it in Game of Thrones. Now we see it as like fully functional. One of her handlers shows up and kind of they have a fun little interaction. What is the name of this dragon, by the way? Syrax, right?
Syrax. Yeah.
Syrax. And she makes the comment, soon Syrax will be as large as Caraxes, who I think is Daemon's dragon. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Matt Smith's character, Daemon.
And they make this bizarre comment, big enough to saddle two. I think it's big enough to saddle two already. like, I don't think it needs to grow to be big enough to saddle two. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't really understand much about like the mechanics of dragon saddles and at what point it's necessary. I mean, again, that's a fun thing where like we didn't ever get to see Dany with like a full proper dragon saddle. So the idea that there's it's almost like ordering like a custom car or something. Like, oh, we might be able to like upgrade our saddle setup here to two pretty soon.
The saddle only sits on a small section of the dragon's spine, basically, and like that section needs to be big enough to fit too. Otherwise, forget about it. I mean, I don't think there were dragon saddles back in Game of Thrones, right? It was just people clinging on to that thing for dear life, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
Just hanging on.
Grasping the horns hoping nothing goes wrong.
Then we meet Alicent Hightower. Alicent Hightower is the daughter of Otto Hightower, who is the Hand of the King. Young Alicent Hightower is played by Emily Carey. Mm-hmm. And they clearly have a really strong friendship, possibly more based on the chemistry they have in this episode. But it's clear that they like are close and have like a fun banter with each other. Now, can you remind us, Kim, who are the Hightowers?
Yeah, so the Hightowers are one of the noble houses that comes from the Reach, which is the same place Game of Thrones fans might remember, like House Tyrell. It was a very powerful family from the Reach by the time of the Game of Thrones, the events in Game of Thrones. But at this point in time, it's really the Hightowers are like the most notable family. They live in Old Town, which is the place where basically like all the maesters have like their big libraries, archives, conduct most of their business. You'll know Old Town from, that's where Sam Tarly went when he decided to try and become a maester for the Night's Watch. And so they, yeah, have this sort of like, almost like academic nobility to them that's a little bit distinct.
And I should point out that Rhys Ifans plays Otto Hightower, Hand of the King, in this episode, who we'll meet shortly. So then Alicent and Rhaenyra go back to the Red Keep and they like walk through it. And we hear like a very cool variation of the Game of Thrones theme. It's like it's like the Game of Thrones theme, but like in a major key almost. Like it's interesting. It's different. And we kind of are introduced to like all these locations we've seen before. The map room before the map was there. Mm-hmm. You know, these massive like towers and so on and so forth. And then she has this conversation with the queen, Emma Targaryen, played by Cian Brooke, who Rhaenyra basically says, I don't want to be a, you know, princess. I want to go out there and kill some dudes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the queen says, we have royal wombs, you and I. The childbed is our battlefield. Don't you understand? Anyway, any thoughts about the Red Keep, this interaction, before we get to what's next?
Yeah, I just, again, for a choice about world building, it's like, they didn't have to remind us of the Red Keep, but the way that they did it helps, again, like, reestablish this place as a time of prosperity, a time of, like, just sort of awe and wonder at the wealth and the kingdom that the Targaryens have built here. Because, yeah, like, they show that map room. They also do, like, a long sweeping shot of one of the towers, which is where the Hound and his brother fought, like, Clegane Bowl that happened in that, again, in that same episode that Miguel Sapochnik directed in season 8, where the Mountain and the Hound fought to the death. Like, that entire area was completely destroyed. And so, again, we're getting this, like, beautiful sweeping shot of, like, oh, look at how grand it once was. But it's like seeing, like, the Titanic, like, in its heyday, knowing what happens to it later. So, yeah. I really liked that choice of, like, gentle reminders of things that happened before, but putting them in a completely different context for this show.
So then we have a scene with King Viserys and the Small Council. We meet Lord Corlys Velaryon, who's played by Steve Toussaint. And I do want to call out Stephen Toussaint, I believe, is the correct pronunciation. And I do want to say that it's nice to see some representation in Westeros. You know, the original Game of Thrones was extremely white. Mm-hmm. And in this episode, we have some black folks. We have some Asian folks. We got some brown folks in it. And that's cool to see. It's cool to see.
Yeah,
because it's a fictional world, guys. It's a fictional world. It doesn't have to be exactly like what the Middle Ages was like. But so Lord Corlys Velaryon, who is, by the way, the husband of Rhaenys, right?
Yes.
Rhaenys,
the queen who never was.
Yeah, the queen who never was. So she was the one that wasn't chosen in the opening scene.
Yes.
But Lord Corlys is like one of the folks in the council. He warns about this triarchy led by Kragas Drahar, which, if you've listened to A Cast of Kings, you know is basically like a vicious pirate. We also learn that Rhaenyra is a cupbearer, and she's kind of going around pouring stuff into people's cups, listening to all this horrifying news that's happening in the Small Council. I thought it was pretty cool. Like, one of my disappointments with Game of Thrones was that we didn't see the Small Council do that much work in general. Mm. Ned shows up, they have one meeting, and then, like, maybe a couple of other meetings. But, like, I thought the idea of, oh, running a kingdom is actually hard, you know?
Yeah.
And we're going to show you how hard it is. It's kind of interesting. And so I wonder if the fact that so much focus was on the Small Council this episode means we're going to see, like, more Small Council in the episodes going forward. That would be cool. I think it's, like, interesting, like, what it would be like to, like, manage a city. Really, I want my Game of Thrones stuff to be, like, The Sims, you know? Or SimCity, basically, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I really liked how it almost feels, and, like, Viserys is kind of, like, joking around, and he's peeling a hard-boiled egg, and you almost get the sense that, like, they do this, like, 9 a.m. morning meeting every day to, like, check
it's
in.
It's a 9 a.m. stand-up. They're using Agile, you know? But the, it's kind of cool that it's, like, this is the daily grind. A lot of people have compared King Viserys to, like, Denethor in Lord of the Rings, you know, like, because they're both hapless people who eat during these meetings that are important.
Don't give Viserys a cherry tomato. I'll kill you.
Indeed. Indeed. Other people at this meeting, again, Otto Hightower, Hand of the King, who I thought was awesome in this episode. Like, he has a very kind of dignified air to him, and feels like he's kind of almost like the Sean Bean-esque character from this show. Mm. Like, he actually gives a crap about the kingdom and the king. From what I can tell so far, right?
I find him very unreadable, which is interesting to me, given how clearly powerful he is. Whereas Corlys is, like, much more direct. I really like the energy that Lord Corlys has at that table, where he's like, hey, I have business to talk about. Why aren't we talking about it? And, like, he's also notably the only person who doesn't drink any wine. I love, like, that little moment. He kind of, like, puts his hand over his cup when Rhaenyra passes by, because he's like,
no, we're, I need to be clear-minded here about like the business at hand. Whereas everyone else at the table is a little more relaxed and aloof.
What are we in, an episode of Mad Men here? Corliss is asking.
Right. Anyway. I was just like, this is the 9 a.m. meeting and they're all drinking wine. It's like having mimosas at the corporate brunch.
Other people at the meeting, Lord Lionel Strong, played by Gavin Spokes, who's Master of Laws and Lord of Harrenhal, and Lord Lyman Beesbury, played by Bill Patterson, who's Master of Coin. I don't think you need to like learn those names right now. It doesn't really matter, but Kim wrote them in the notes, and so I wanted to call them out. So
thanks, Dave.
so then we meet Daemon Targaryen, played by Matt Smith. Rhaenyra is taken to the throne room, and we see Daemon sitting on the Iron Throne. And the Iron Throne looks very different than when we originally saw it. Kim, you want to tell us why you think this Iron Throne looks different than what it was in Game of Thrones?
Yeah, for sure. George R. R. Martin certainly always had a little bit of a bee in his bonnet about the fact that the Iron Throne on Game of Thrones did not match his description as written in the books. In the books, it's described as like massive, towering, very asymmetrical, covered, like just so many swords. And the version that we got in Game of Thrones was obviously like easier to sit on and just kind of shaped like a chair, but made out of swords and didn't have that sort of like unruly aspect to it. And so clearly Ryan Condal and Miguel Sapochnik have decided that they can use the fact that this is so much further back in history to have a slightly different decorated throne room in general, and then specifically like a different design for the Iron Throne. So yeah, there are way more swords in the chair itself, and then they've kind of put them all like melted and ascending down the stairs of the throne. So that way, anytime you even get close to speaking to whoever is sitting there, you are facing down a lot of sharp blades that could cause some fatal wounds.
Yeah,
just like a little more intimidating, a little more unruly, and I think fitting for this era of Targaryen rule.
Don't trip near the Iron Throne is kind of the message that's the take home, right? Do not take a spill, or else it might be your last.
Yeah.
I think you also called out, Kim, in the notes that this sitting on the Iron Throne, like Daemon sitting on the Iron Throne, kind of mirrors a scene from Game of Thrones where Jaime was chilling near the Iron Throne in the first episode, I think, of that show, right?
Yeah. Well, no, it would be the second, because it's when Ned arrives to King's Landing.
Yeah, when they get to King's Landing, right. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like there was a similar like sort of one-on-one scene between Ned and Jaime in the throne room where you're sort of establishing a very tense relationship between the two of them. And then in the books, there's also like Ned speaks about his memories of the day that Robert's Rebellion successfully usurped the throne, and seeing Jaime in that throne room with like the blood of the king on his sword. And so it's like, it's the idea that someone who is not the king is sitting anywhere near or on the throne is very, you know, it's hearsay. That's why you see that like the Kingsguard sort of respond in that way when the door opens. And Rhaenyra is like, oh, don't worry about it. It's just my crazy uncle being weird again. And like, Daemon is the presumed heir at this point. So he's like clearly overconfident about his ability to flout royal protocol.
Yeah. And he gives Rhaenyra a Valyrian steel necklace. Whole scene feels really weird. Kind of has like incest vibes to it, I thought. Or kind of incest vibes, or he wants to kill her vibes. I couldn't figure out what was going on there. I don't know if you had a take on it.
Yeah, no, the vibes are weird. That I was like, this is a grown man and a child. And he's like gifting her something that almost seems romantic, but then at the same time is like, could be read as just like an intimate exchange of this like precious metal between Targaryens, because Valyrian steel is very important to the Targaryens. Like it has sort of like a level of honor among them because it is tied so closely to dragons and to magic. And the idea, like it's a very valuable metal. And so the idea that he like sought out this like Valyrian steel necklace for her and gifted it to her, especially, it's like, okay, is that like an uncle doting upon his niece? Is this what are the vibes happening here? And at the same time, yes, she is the only living direct descendant of the current king, which sets up some tension there too.
Yeah. She also mentions Dark Sister, which you have pointed out is the name of Damon's Valyrian steel sword.
Yeah, so Dark Sister, it's kind of like how in the pilot of Game of Thrones, I think someone offhandedly mentioned Ice, which is Ned Stark's sword. Like, you see him unsheath it and behead the Night's Watch person, but no one ever, like, sits to pause and be like, oh, that sword's very special because it's made of Valyrian steel. So I think they were just doing a similar thing of, like, having an aside mention where people who know will know, and then folks like me will explain, like, oh, Dark Sister is that the sword that is on his hip, and it's one of the ancestral Targaryen swords.
That was what was missing from the episode, Kim. Oh, that sword's oh, special.
Nice special Valyrian steel sword you got there, Uncle. Yeah. This is
you
why
really needed that. It really is missing a lot without it. Okay. There is a scene with Rhaenyra and Alicent in the Godswood where she's kind of learning the history of the land and all this stuff like that. Like, I, you know, I don't know if there's anything worth highlighting from this scene that you want to mention.
I think it builds well upon what they were doing with Rhaenyra in earlier scenes, which is sort of setting her up to have a similar personality and outlook on life to Arya Stark. Like,
right.
That seems like the biggest parallel, where she's sort of like very dismissive of things like the Septa's wants and needs. She doesn't really have any interest in marriage and childbirth the way that Sansa does at the start of Game of Thrones. Like, she just wants to, like, have her freedom, ride her dragon, and flirt with Alicent Hightower in the Godswood.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Which, yeah, you mentioned those vibes. I do get more than friends vibes from Rhaenyra and Alicent, especially, like, this scene is so, like, I don't know. I saw echoes of, like, the types of female friendships that I had when I was a teenager, but also, like, with this tinge of, like, oh, is this feeling that I have for you more than friendship? How do you define that?
Mm-hmm.
Girlhood is it's a tricky subject. And I will say, maybe this is a good place to note, I'm going to have a full article about this up sometime this week, but I spoke with the actors Millie Alcott and Emily Carey specifically about this. It came up in my roundtable interview. And Millie was sort of like, it might seem like we're in love because I just love Emily a lot. And, like, that chemistry was sort of, like, there. And then Emily, who is a queer woman, said, like, oh, I absolutely saw that subtext in that. And we were very aware of the fact that, like, this is, like, a weird gray area of, like, bonding that they've experienced as 14-year-olds. That's also probably a good thing to note. I asked specifically how old all the characters are supposed to be, and both Rhaenyra and Alicent are supposed to be 14 years old at this point in the story.
Gotcha. All right. We cut to King Viserys, who has oozing sores on his back, which is kind of funny just because it's like a very, it's like a metaphor, right? And also, generally, whenever you see someone with oozing sores, they're going to die. So it's like telegraphing that they're not going to live. I don't know if they survive or not and how long they survive, but, like, it's, you know, it's like if you see someone in a TV show with a cough, like, they're doomed. The oozing sore is the cough of Westeros, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
One of my favorite tweets from last night was like, Dr. Pimple Popper would have known what that is. I was like, where's the Dr. Pimple Popper of Westeros when you need her?
Yeah. Do you know what's going on there, or do you think it's going to be revealed later?
I don't entirely know. There are, like, a variety of health things mentioned in connection to Viserys. I think that we're not supposed to have a ton of clarity on that at this point in the story.
Yeah. But it looks bad. Looks bad.
Yep. Not great, Bob.
Viserys has a conversation with his wife, Emma, while she's in the bath. They exchange a lot of words about the history of trying to produce a male heir. There have been stillbirths and failed births. And obviously, Rhaenyra is not a male. And so, like, it's all hasn't gone according to plan. And she says that it's probably going to be a girl named Visenya. That she would like to name it Visenya. But it's kind of obviously at this point, we still don't know what's going to happen. Whereas Viserys is, like, really insistent that it's going to be a dude. He's, like, really sure. Anything from this scene that you wanted to highlight, Kim?
Well, one was a little line detail that I think was an intentional reference back to the A Song of Ice and Fire books, which is, like, Emma says, I wouldn't be surprised if I hatched an actual dragon. And in the books, there's a lot of detail added about the experience that Dany has in, and we see this in the first season where she's pregnant with Khal Drogo's child. There's all these prophecies around, like, you know, the stallion who mounts the world, that like this baby is going to be very important. And then during the course of her like solicitation of Miri Mazdoor, who was sort of like a witch woman, to help her, Dany loses the baby because she doesn't realize that that's the life that she's exchanging for Khal Drogo's. And she kind of like basically like blacks out whenever like the actual birth happens. And later she's told that the creature had like scaly flesh and like bat-like wings and like all of these like descriptors that are kind of like a dragon. And so Emma sort of like jokes about it. And then in my head, I was like, well, Dany sort of like did literally birth some sort of dragon baby when she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And then of course she actually manages to hatch all of her three dragon eggs. So that was just sort of like a fun lore nod. But I think overall, I again like this scene for the character work that it's doing, because Viserys is clearly like, he's very loving towards her. Like you feel that they have a bond, but he's also kind of just not listening to her. Like she's saying, like, I'm literally sitting in this bath because it's the only place I can feel comfortable right now. Like she's clearly kind of struggling in these like later months of her pregnancy. And he's just very like, oh, it's going to be fine. I had a dream about it. Don't worry. This boy's definitely, or like this baby's definitely a boy and everything's going to be great. And I'm like, maybe just like sit and empathize with your extremely pregnant, sad wife who's saying like she literally cannot deal with having another like miscarriage or stillbirth again after this. Yeah. So,
I mean, that's fair, Kim. I would also say though that she does seem to have like quite a bit of agency in the relationship, you know, at least at this point where she's like drawing about, she's like, no more, can't do it anymore after this. And he's like, seems at least open to that idea. Where yeah. as opposed to like typically what we'd see in the scenario is she doesn't get any say at all, you know?
Yeah.
So they do have a strong enough relationship that he's open to her feedback on the whole pregnancy thing.
Right. That she's even able to say something like that.
Exactly.
Would not be the case with many marriages at this time in this fictional universe, for sure.
All right. Cut to Daemon going on a brutal Judge Dredd type rampage through the city. Where he is judge, jury, and executioner. He's cutting people's dicks off. He's cutting people's hands off. He's cutting people's heads off. It's unclear whether or not these people actually did anything, as far as I can tell. And I mean, later on, he's like, hey, a lot of those, you know, Matt Smith's like, a lot of those people were pretty evil, but it's like, I think we are meant to not be clear on whether or not he was acting in the right, from my perspective.
I mean, just logistically, I'm like, what, did you have like medieval FBI's most wanted list photos mm-hmm. of these? Like, how did, it's dark. I'm like, how did you know that that's the person who raped someone all those years ago? Like, it wasn't like they went down to a prison cell and decided to like carry out a sentence.
Right.
Like, it did seem to have a lot of chaos to me. And then it was interesting that at the small council table, they're like, oh, well, these were all known thieves and rapers and whatever. And I'm like, okay, I guess we just have to believe you that you knew that. Seems kind of brutal to me. And yeah. And yeah, yeah, random.
But yeah, there is a small council meeting where they disapprove strongly of his actions. There's a question I had about like, what is up with this little marble at the small council meetings? Like, it seems like he has to put it down to be there, but then like he leaves without taking it with him. So it's like, what's the deal with that? Do you have any idea what that is?
I don't. And I wish I had asked this question of the showrunners. If I get the opportunity to at any point in the future, I will. Because yeah, I don't really know what that is. And I agree with you that it seems to be some sort of like ceremonial indication that you are like at the table and ready to talk. But beyond that, it's like what, having your mic on at like the UN council? Something like
I thought it was like it was not yeah it not even Mike, it was more like you have standing to be here was kind of my interpretation of it.
As but, if like you carry that marble with you at all times.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, it's not like
it was like the talking stick basically that you, or the conch from Lord of the Flies, but then he didn't, when he left, he didn't take it with him anyway. It was
right
weird.
Yeah, I don't know.
I should point out that during these small council scenes we also learn a little bit more about Matt Smith's character. Like he has a wife, right?
Yeah.
And he's not super thrilled with his wife.
No.
And not super thrilled that he's kind of spends a lot of his, or theoretically, like, has been asked to spend more of his time away from King's Landing and so on. He has a really harsh confrontation with Otto Hightower, which I thought was great because you can tell Otto is just like raging because Otto's wife has apparently died recently and Damon makes fun of him about it basically. And, you know, you could have my wife if you want, you know, it's just like, it's all very unpleasant vibes that, that Damon is sowing into this place. Right.
Yeah. And Viserys very notably, like, I don't think handles it super well. Mm-mm. Like, he's very clearly protecting Damon and sort of like placating. Like, he's like, Otto, like, you know, my brother loves to take a rise out of you. Like, why do you always like, must you meet it or whatever? And I'm like, it's a weird choice to decide to chastise the hand of the king whose dead wife has just been like low-key insulted, as opposed to telling your brother like, hey, dude, cut it out. But yeah. Like, you get the dynamic there that Damon, and like Damon gets like a little look on his face. Viserys kind of like says something to him like, you know, I like, just don't do this again. And like everything short of like winking at Damon in that moment happens. And Matt Smith, I think, does a really good job of getting this little look on his face where he knows that he's gotten away with something. And he's like, of course, Your Grace. And like, I don't know. I also love his wig in that scene. That was my favorite wig moment of the episode. He looks like he's all like dirtied up and in his like armor. He reminds me of like Legolas after battle with like the little pieces in front of his ears. I really liked it.
Yeah. It's a great interaction. I agree. Also, he mentioned, I think his wife is in the Vale. Is that right?
Yeah. So the Vale,
what is the Vale for those who don't remember?
The Vale is the part of Westeros where, House Arryn lives. It's like that, you know, impregnable mountain fortress castle where Lysa Arryn, who's Catelyn Stark's sister, sort of like holds herself up. And she was a very unpleasant character. So I almost feel like they're, you know, leaning into this idea that like all women from the Vale must be just like unpleasant and terrible to be around, which I don't think is fair. But that seems to be what they're going for there. So yeah, she lives near that same area in Westeros, which would maybe be a decent wagon ride away, but we know that Daemon has a dragon. So it's like he could probably get there in a couple hours whenever he wanted to. But clearly he has not been commuting back and forth from his lady wife to King's Landing.
We cut to Damon going to have sex in a brothel, doggy style, because it's, I don't know if you're aware of this, but on HBO, if you have sex, it's mandated that it be doggy style. So just FYI.
I've never been less attracted to a naked man than in that scene. It was so uncomfortable, which I guess was the point that like he's like having a tantrum, like an internal tantrum in the middle of having sex with Miss Arya.
Yeah. So we meet Miss Arya, who's played by Sonoya Mizuno, very talented actor who has appeared in Ex Machina and Crazy Rich Asians. She is doing an accent in the show. And I had a question like, what do you think this accent is? What's your guess as to what this accent is?
Yeah, that was one of the first questions that I wrote down too in this scene, because Sonoya Mizuno is British. So like if you hear her talking in interviews and everything,
right?
She has a British accent. So,
this is not her normal accent, basically.
Right. Like a choice has been made about her character, and I'm not quite sure what she's trying to do. I think people have theorized that because in the books, this character is described as albino, you know, just a lot of pale people in these books. And they very clearly cast an Asian actress for this role. And so in the books, her character is from Lys, which is an island off the coast of Essos. I think people think that maybe they've added some like dimension or like rewriting to her character, because we know that she's been, the whole narrative in both the books and the show is that like she's been sold into slavery multiple times. And so now she's in King's Landing and has formed this relationship with Damon. They might be trying to have her like country of origin or like area of origin be Yeti, which is like the far, far east in Essos. So if Westeros, as we know, is kind of like a UK, Northern Ireland hybrid
continent that George has drawn inspiration from. So like Yeti would be like in relation to England as like China or Japan or like those like far farther east countries are. And so maybe she's drawn up some new accent that is supposed to signal that that's where she's originally from. But I don't know. I'm curious to see if she talks more about like in any interviews or stuff about the decision behind that accent, because it definitely, I was like, oh, you're not just like, she could have just been speaking in a British accent the way that like all of the other characters are
on
the show.
Yeah. And I do think it's kind of setting up character dynamics similar to, honestly, the character dynamics that happened with prostitutes in Game of Thrones show, right? Like there was a couple of notable prostitutes in Game of Thrones, Roz, and also Tyrion's
Shay,
right? His main squeeze. And so so it feels like there's a similar dynamic where like she's going to be like a kind of confidant person who like Lady Macbeth style, you know, helps him out. We'll see.
Yeah, you get the sense that she's the only person who really sees Daemon, you know, curl into a ball and act like a baby and need to be talked out of his feelings.
Men will go to a brothel instead of therapy, instead of doing therapy. So then we have the tournament, you know, which is like just really, really technically impressive. Like it looks like they went out into the world and they shot people riding horses at each other with sticks, and like people got grievously injured. It looks like, I don't think that actually happened. I don't think anyone actually died from this, but the whole way it's shot, the whole way it's executed, looks like tons of extras, horses, people getting hurt. Like it looks incredible. So I thought the whole sequence was excellent from that perspective. One of the things you've called out in previous A Cast of Kings episode is that House of the Dragon's going to have more bright colors and heraldry than in the past, right?
Yeah.
And so I think we certainly see that on display here.
Yeah, I really loved, I loved the staging of this. I thought it was, again, like we saw a tournament in early Game of Thrones that Robert was presiding over, and he was like sort of a drunkard and it felt a little more like haphazard, whereas this was like, it was like watching the Super Bowl of Westeros. Yes.
Well, they also have approximately like $50 million more dollars to make this one, you know?
Yeah. And it shows like, like truly incredible, like production design work and all of the stunt casting with like so many horses and swords and jousts. And I thought it was riveting. I loved this scene.
There's like a ton of names thrown out there. Like we hear, what are some of the names you recall hearing during this scene?
Yeah, so Criston Cole is introduced, who is a knight. He's basically from like a virtually unknown house, which is why some people are like, oh, who's this guy from? I've never seen him before. And then he takes off his helmet and Allison's like, oh, he's Dornish. Like, very,
I love your impression. Most of your impressions are just the same person and they sound like this. By the way, Kim. Anyway, I love it. Love it.
Yeah, that's what my inside voice, that's what my head sounds like all the time. Again, send help. I'm fine. We meet Criston Cole, who is a very skilled fighter, but not from any sort of like famous noble house. And then Daemon, at some point, basically because he's the prince, gets to choose who he battles first, and he selects Otto Hightower's son. And so that was just sort of like one more way for him to sort of twist the knife at Otto, I guess.
I thought Otto Hightower's son was going to be dead.
I know.
But I don't believe he dies.
No.
Because they would have been really upset about that, and they weren't.
Just gets really battered. So
yeah,
that's fun.
Anything else to point out in this scene? We see kind of Alicent and Rhaenyra's differing reactions to the battle. Rhaenyra is like very excited by all the blood. Alicent is like picking her fingernails until they're bleeding, I think, right? So they clearly have very different reactions to violence.
Yeah, and they also take the time to show us, so Lord Corlys and Rhaenys' children, they have two children who are sitting kind of off to the side from Alicent and Rhaenyra. Their names are Laena and Laenor. Don't have to remember that right now, but they show those two children sort of like also tensing up and like having a physical reaction to the violence in front of them. And then they show like what I'm guessing is like a young squire or someone on the field like throwing up. And I just thought it was like that paired with then the conversation between Corlys and Rhaenys about how like none of these people have seen war. Because again, as we established at the very beginning of the episode, there's been peace in the realm for more than 60 years. So these knights and the people participating in this tournament who are maybe in their like late teens, 20s have like literally never experienced battle. So this is like the most violence that they see. And you see how the children are being impacted as well by seeing like skulls bashed in front of their heads or horses flipped over and necks getting broken. And I thought that that was interesting because yeah, these kids are in for some rough awakenings in Westeros.
Well, it's clear that Rhaenyra is really into it. And I mean, they cut to her like 10 times, it seems like, just to be like, I don't know if you guys can tell, she's really into all this violence, guys. She's really into it. So
it's FYI. Funny. I guess I read that more as her being really interested in Daemon specifically. Mm. Like she tends to like really just keep a close eye on what he's doing. Cause I think she finds his like, I don't even know how to describe, like, it's like she finds his demeanor very compelling. Whereas mm-hmm. you see that so many other people are very turned off by it. They find him very grating or over the top or annoying, but she clearly thinks that like Daemon is doing something right in the way that he behaves in the kingdom.
Interesting. Interesting. So while this is happening, the queen is in labor and we learn what happens when government interferes with a woman's health during the pregnancy process. It is a horrifying scene and extremely graphic, I would say. And it's rare to see a scene like that depicted in anything, let alone a TV show. And it's heartbreaking because obviously like she kind of understands what's going on as it's happening. Like she understands that King Viserys has made the call to like extract this baby and she knows what it means for her and she kind of begs for her life. And it's the whole thing is like between that and like how brutal it is when they cut her open, probably one of the most upsetting things in this episode.
Absolutely. If not one of the more violent things we see, one of the more graphic things we see in the whole series too. And I think back to like Game of Thrones. Yeah, it was really very visceral, very, I don't know. The heartbreaking thing to me about it was once again, like Viserys does not seem to be listening to her. Like she keeps saying like, I'm scared. I can't do this anymore. And instead of like, really, oh, you froze for me, Dave.
Oh no, I'm still here.
Oh no, were you just sitting really still?
Yes.
Sorry.
It's amazing. It's amazing. You're like, are you dead, David?
You?
No, I'm still here.
You're buffering. No, I appreciate how intensely you were listening to me speak. Thank
yes,
you.
I was hanging on your every word. Sorry for paying attention to you, Kim. Okay, sorry.
I'm sorry. I interrupted myself. No, it's like the way it seems clear that Emma is going to die either way. Like if she just continues to not be able to give birth to this baby, yeah. It's going to kill her. And obviously this medieval C-section procedure that they do is guaranteed to kill her. The thing for me is not like, oh, there was a way for Viserys to save her life and he didn't. He chose to save her son instead. It's that he made that decision without talking to her and without telling her, like, I'm so sorry, love of my life. Like, you are dying and there's nothing we can do for you, but we might be able to save the baby. Like, whatever. But the way that he just says like, they're going to bring the baby now. And then like, she gets dragged down and like physically restrained.
Yeah. The way like they pull her down, it's like, it basically is like, she's now like lost control of the process, right? Like the way they stage it is really effective. Yeah.
And she's saying like, no, no. Like she's screaming and she it clicks for her what's about to happen. And Viserys has no comfort to offer her or anything. He just keeps kind of like shushing her and being like, it's going to be okay. And it's like, it's awful. Well,
yeah. I would say a couple things about this scene, which is probably like kind of one of the climactic scenes of the episode, right? Mm-hmm. Thing number one is that it kind of reinforces what we know about Viserys' character, that like he doesn't like having hard conversations, right?
Yeah.
Like, and totally. That was obvious earlier on, and now it's very, and he's like, and when he is called to have a really pretty important conversation with his wife, he decides to opt out of it.
Yeah.
And it's the last thing his wife is ever going to know about him. And the second thing is like the way this scene is edited, it draws this parallel between, you know, the violence on the at the tournament and then like the violence here. We should point out, by the way, that like the violence of the tournament, these people have never seen war before, right? So
yeah,
there's almost this kind of whatever inherent bloodlust they have is they're green, but B, whatever inherent bloodlust they have is being taken out via this tournament.
Yeah, but, like they have to find a reason.
Yes, exactly. But the way it's edited, I think, is meant to kind of draw this parallel between, obviously, the two scenarios. And you can interpret it however you will, but one of the ways to interpret it is, like, basically, like, life is difficult for both men and women, right? Like, men need to sacrifice their lives and get maimed and stuff like that, and women their bodies are used to produce heirs, and often, like, their agency is taken from them in that process. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
yeah,
it's hard out there in Westeros, basically.
Yeah. I'm like, do the men, do they have to, do they have to do that? Is that,
it's so essential, for celebrating the birth of this child. You know?
Uh-huh.
How dare you question the wisdom of these men hitting each other, Kim? I don't know.
Yeah,
doesn't feel right.
Of all the reasons to die, trying to do some horse riding tricks doesn't really seem like a very good one. Mm. But to each their own.
So the child is born and it's like alive for a few hours, but then like you see I think it's a maester. Who's holding mm-hmm. it, and he kind of gets this concerned look. I thought it was very artfully done, actually. He gets this concerned look on his face, cut to the funeral of both the wife and the child.
Yeah.
And
there's like a sickly sort of like, you hear like the baby kind of stop crying, and instead there's like a little like sickly cough thing. Like if you listen, and it sounds like the baby's having trouble getting air or like breathing properly. And I think that's like the little concern on the maester's face. And then boom, dead baby bundle on a funeral pyre.
Yeah. So Rhaenyra is like very upset about the whole thing, and obviously she's lost her mom and also her sibling. And she does say Dracarys to light the funeral pyres on fire, which is, hey, it's a reference to the thing that you knew before.
Mm-hmm.
This kicks off a massive issue with succession in the kingdom, because they thought that, Emma's child was going to be the heir, but that's no longer the case. So who is going to be the heir? Now, I want to start by saying, with this scene with the small council, Kim, they have got to improve security in the small council room. Okay? Because Matt Smith, who plays Daemon, is just hanging out in the background. Guys, this is like, this is basically the Mar-a-Lago of Westeros, right? Like people can just like creep in lurk in these rooms while like confidential stuff is being discussed. Like it's not cool.
I did want to see like where he was.
I think there was like, if you're looking at Viserys straight on, like on the right side of the room, there's like a wall that has these big circle things in it. Like that's kind of where I thought he was.
Okay.
But it's also like a place that would be incredibly obvious if someone was standing there. So anyway, guys, you are King's Landing. Okay. You are the seat of the kingdom. Have a security guard effing do a walkthrough before, you know, you have a really top secret important meeting. Okay. It's the least literally the least you can do for something this important.
True.
But everyone airs out all their thoughts about Daemon and confirms what we already think, which is like the dude is a freaking psychopath. You don't want him to be head of the Iron Throne. Viserys is really kind of doesn't want to deal with any of this, basically, right?
Yeah. Like you said, that's a really pivotal aspect to his character. He can't have hard conversations. And this is probably the hardest conversation aside from murdering his wife. Which, by the way, I interviewed Miguel Sapochnik and he did say like Viserys effectively murdered her. And that's why that scene is so horrible. And I'm like, yeah. But yeah, this is another example of like he cannot look at things straight on.
Yeah. So let's talk about what else happens this episode. I want to know more about Maegor. Like, he says Daemon would be a second Maegor. Maybe we can save that for the bonus segment that we do, Kim.
Yeah.
Then there's a scene where Allison and Otto are talking. Allison's talking to her dad, Otto, and Otto is like writing a message to Old Town, right?
Yeah, which I'm assuming is like sent to some of his family, because as we've established, the High Towers, that's like where their noble house resides, is by Old Town. And so when he says like send this right away, I'm assuming that he's communicating something with a family member, but I'm not sure what.
Otto sends Alicent to keep the king company, which is like really upsetting the way in which it's done, you know, because it's clear that it might lead to something sexual, I think, right? Like, was my interpretation. He's like, and wear one of your dead mom's dresses, you know?
That clinched it for me. I was like, what's the motivation here? Maybe he genuinely just knows, like, Alicent did recently lose her mother as well. But, like, I'm like, wouldn't Alicent be more of a comfort to Rhaenyra right now? But no, we're going to send her to the old grieving king's room and then specifically be like, yeah, wear one of your old mother's, your dead mother's dresses.
Wear one of your dead mother's. The sexier, the better. Is kind of, it's pretty gross. And kind of, again, like, the whole time, I'm thinking Otto is like the upstanding character in this whole show, right? And then that's one of the things that the Game of Thrones universe does, is like reconfigures your assumptions all the time. You think someone's evil, they're good, they're complicated. You think someone's good, but they're actually complicated. They do terrible things as well, right? So,
yeah.
And then so Alicent and Viserys have a conversation in his room. He has this huge scale model of King's Landing. Maybe that's why there was no opening title sequence, is because he was still building the model that was going to be in the sequence.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. And then she like brings a book for them to like hang out and talk about a little bit.
Which I thought was really sweet. Like, she has, I really like all of Allison's instincts in this episode of like what to say. She's very polite, very like, I'm just a noblewoman at court. And then for a young girl who clearly doesn't quite know what she's doing in that room, I think she does a pretty good job of carrying the conversation and making it as less as unawkward as it's possible to be.
Yeah.
When your best friend's dad is building a little city model and grieving his wife. They're indeed. All like, Viserys and Daemon are just like big children. Like, they're clearly men who know how to command power and do a lot of like kingly things. But then whenever you see them behind closed doors, they seem so much more like diminished. It's really interesting to me.
Well, I mean, you know, Kim, I don't know if I like this bias against model building people.
Model building isn't childish inherently. I think the way
a lot of model builders listening to this right now. I'm putting that out there. So
truly, I do not mean that like you can't have a hobby like that and not be a grown man or woman or person. Like, more power to you. But I think that it is staged in this scene as he is using it as a reason to not be a king and a ruler and the grown person that he's supposed to be. He's
100%.
Like hiding in his room and playing with his toys.
100% agree. 100% agreed.
Yeah.
Cut to Daemon in a brothel. And he kind of decides to give a speech about the whole, all the stuff that's happened and toast to like the heir for a day or whatever, the heir for a day, referring to his dead nephew, I guess it is, right?
Yes. Which again is like really like stoked by Missaria. Like, she kind of like eggs him on very specifically in this scene, which I think is notable.
This scene also had probably the the most hilarious image of the entire episode in an episode that did not have very much humor, in my opinion, which is when he starts giving his speech, there is a guy who is literally having sex doggy style. Remember my statement from earlier? And he kind of like, the guy like literally still mid doggy style turns around and like looks at the speech. And it's like, is he just going to stay in that position for the next 5-10 minutes while Matt Smith gives a speech? You know, like, what's guys, just if you want to pay attention to the speech, just like take a break, you know, get a seat, get a drink, watch the speech, and then you can go back to what you're doing. But like the idea of being like mid dog, just like staying in that position and turning around to look at the speech is just so bizarre and funny from a staging perspective. Anyway.
Yeah. And awful from the woman's perspective.
Right. Go ahead.
You're just there on all fours, like waiting for these dudes to stop looking at each other.
It is absurd and terrible. You know?
I would never want to be a sex worker in Westeros. There is upside to that job.
She should have just, you know, she could say, like, look, if you want to watch the speech, let's just watch the speech and then we can go back to the, you know, like, maybe she should have said something, you know?
I'm sure that's well within her power. I'm sure she has a lot of control over the situation that's happening in that room.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. That's probably not in the consideration, not in her consideration set there, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Okay, so word of this gets back to Viserys. He gets super pissed that basically Daemon was making light of his son's death. And then Daemon's like, look, we all deal with grief in our own ways, Viserys. Okay, like, you can't judge me. Some people build models. You know, others of us, you know, toast at brothels. Like, it's all part of a spectrum, okay? So then basically Viserys banishes Daemon from the kingdom. And lets him ride off on his dragon.
I love this scene because it's one of, I think it's a clever character move of having arguably, like, your worst character say, like, the most true thing to someone. Like, I think that Daemon's read of, like, that Viserys is weak and doesn't have strength in the ways that he needs it. But like, of course, that's saying that true thing in that moment is not going to help him at all. But it kind of lets the audience know, like, okay, like, Daemon does know what he's talking about, even if he's terrible. Like, he's not wrong, but he's bad.
There's that Clickhole article, heartbreaking. The worst person you know just made a great point.
Yeah.
Which is basically what happens in this scene. So Viserys realizes, like, Daemon can't be or shouldn't be the king. Shouldn't be near him at all.
Yeah.
There's also this lovely moment where he kind of cuts himself on the Iron Throne, I think, right? Is that?
Yes. And that's something, like, George R. R. Martin kind of seeds that in during his explanations of different kings' reigns, because there's, like, there's this symbolic idea that the Iron Throne will reject unworthy rulers. And the way that that happens is if they tend to get a lot of cuts and scrapes while they are literally sitting on the throne. Like, the, and again, that kind of harkens back to George's quibble with the show, how, like, smooth and kind of like easy of a chair it looked like it was to sit in. It's supposed to be hostile even to the king sitting in it. And so it's like, it's a little bit of symbolism about, like, if the Iron Throne is literally cutting you and making you bleed, it's usually an indication that maybe you aren't a very good king.
Final sequence of the episode. They're in this underground keep of some kind. Viserys is holding his hand over these candles. It's really cool. Like, reference to what we understand of the Targaryens, like, they theoretically can't be burned, right? Is that the
in
lore?
The show's universe, they've established that, because, like, George always said that Dany being able to, like, walk into that funeral pyre and survive with during the dragon birth was, like, a one-time magical event. And then the show kind of, like, tossed that out of the canon when they decided to have the whole sequence in season 6 where she, like, burns down a temple with all the calls in it and walks out naked because, like, fire burns her clothes but not her, is the logic there, or her hair. In the books, she's supposed to be, like, completely bald after that funeral pyre scene because the fire would have burned away her hair. So it's been a hotly debated thing of, like, Targaryens aren't really supposed to be, quote unquote, like, fireproof, but the show's adaptations kind of keep leaning into that. So yeah, that like, he held his hand over the candle, like, just past the point that I think a regular person would be able to comfortably hold them. And I think that that was supposed to be a little nod at this idea that Targaryens have some sort of fireproof DNA, but again, that wasn't George's intentions in the book. So it was just a curious moment to me because I'm like, are you just giving a nod to the fact that people sometimes debate about that? Are you trying to reestablish that Targaryens are fireproof in this series? I don't know. Maybe it was just a little fandom stirring moment.
Yeah. So he has a conversation with Rhaenyra. There's a few big fact bombs dropped onto Rhaenyra at this point, right? Thing number one, Rhaenyra is going to be the new queen. She is going to be in the line of succession. It's not technically against the rules. So she's going to be the new queen and she's going to need to process that. And we don't even really get to see her process it during this episode. Like, it's very, very quick. And then I assume we'll kind of understand more about her reaction in the upcoming episodes. Yeah. Number two, Viserys believes that the dragons are not under their control at all. He says, quote, "The idea that we control the dragons is an illusion. They're a power man that man should never have trifled with, one that brought Valyria its doom. And if we don't mind our histories, it will do the same to us," end quote. Wow, this is pretty shocking. You know, like, it's a pretty new dynamic that we just now under, like, for the whole time that we've watched Game of Thrones, we've understood, like, the Targaryens are like dragon riders. They like control these beings, and that's what makes them special, almost like gods. But Viserys doesn't believe that their control is actually that solid, right?
Yeah, I mean, in Game of Thrones, there was a little bit of story built around this idea, because there's the whole part where Dany has like taken up rule over in Essos in like Slaver's Bay, and Drogon is like out of her control because he's killing. Remember, he like kills it. He roasts a child to death. Like, mm-hmm. That man comes and brings like the bones of his daughter to her, and Dany's very upset. So like, there is a little bit of a hint of like, she doesn't quite know how to like rein in the power of these three beasts, and that's why she eventually chains up two of her dragons in like that dungeon keep. But the idea that like, you never got the impression that they would really hurt her, they would just maybe hurt other people. And so yeah, it is interesting to hear it coming from King Viserys' mouth that like, dragons are not something that the Targaryens actually have any control over, but they can bond. They can clearly bond with certain people, like Rhaenyra and Syrax clearly have some sort of a connection where she's able to like saddle him up and ride around with ease. So yeah, it's interesting to kind of like throw people for a loop on exactly what the relationship between the Targaryens and their dragons are.
And Viserys also talks about the prophecy, which I think is what we see in Game of Thrones, right? Like, the Night King and the White Walkers, and is that what is referred to there, right?
It does seem to be what he's referring to, but it's weird because the prophecy didn't happen the way that he's describing Aegon's dream. There mm-hmm. wasn't a Targaryen on the throne when the White Walkers were defeated. Cersei was sitting on the throne.
Well, she got there like right after, you know?
Who did? Cersei?
Dany did.
But she also never actually sat on the throne. Her butt did not touch that chair. Jon murdered her first.
Yeah, yeah.
And okay. It's murky, which like, yeah. George R. R. Martin has said that prophecies are a tricky thing in his universe. They are not guaranteed. So it's mm-hmm. like, did Aegon just misinterpret his dream? Is the prophecy never going to come true in George's version of events? Is it always going to be a little bit like muddled or confusing? Or is the show's version of how that prophecy played out just wrong because Benioff and Weiss had to make it up on their own and George hadn't told them all the nitty gritty details of how the White Walkers are going to defeat it? When I was writing about this, and I literally had sort of like a laugh out loud moment where I was like, I got to the part where I was like, and then the Night King. And I was like, the Night King doesn't exist in the books. That character does not, like, the entire way that the White Walkers were defeated is based around a character that right now George R. R. Martin has not introduced in his story. Mm. So like,
because the idea of the Night King is that like, once Arya killed the Night King using the dagger that we see in this episode, right?
Yes.
And there's an open question of how that dagger gets into all the way to Arya's hands, but once she kills the Night King, like all the White Walkers and all the white zombies like die, basically, right? So, but that doesn't happen in the books, presumably, because there is no Night King character yet.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's weird. It feels like a really big bombshell for book readers because we've never known exactly what made Aegon want to conquer Westeros. And Ryan Condal confirmed with me in an interview that like this detail absolutely came from George. He actually said that it was something that George told them really early in the story break for this show, and that it completely informed the way that they thought about the Targaryens and particularly like the idea of the line of succession. So it's clearly important to George. It's just really interesting the way that it was deployed in this scene, because it's like, okay, does this mean that this secret that's been passed from king to heir, like did that continue all the way through the Targaryens, but then somehow it obviously never made its way to Dany. Dany in the show is not aware of this at all.
Right.
So it's just, I think it's George. It feels to me like George is much more involved in House of the Dragon, and he is able to like inform the story in a very specific way that he clearly was not doing in the later seasons of Game of Thrones. Yeah. Basically after season four, he didn't have very much direct input on the story decisions that were being made.
Interesting. Interesting. I will say it is incredibly clunky when he says, Aegon called his dream the Song of Ice and Fire, which is just like, ugh, like,
that's feels the title pretty... of a book that.
that's the title of the book. It's just, okay. All right. All right. Anyway.
The Leonardo DiCaprio pointing meme.
Yeah. It's kind of like a silly, would you like you call your dream a Song of Ice and Fire? Come on. Anyway. We see like a lot of people like swearing fealty to Rhaenyra. We see Rickard Stark, which is cool with all the Stark get up, you know.
Also they cut to the Stark right after Viserys's line of like, it's to begin with a terrible winter gusting out of the distant north. Boom, smash cut to the Stark ancestors swearing fealty, because we know that obviously like Jon Snow and the Starks are going to play such a big role in this eventual prophecy.
We also see Lord Corlys, Hightower, and also Baratheon. All right. And that basically takes us to the end, where Rhaenyra needs to face an uncertain future with this new role. So that's the first episode of the House of the Dragon. That's the first episode of Cast of Kings. Any other thoughts, Kim? I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that we actually didn't get to that we will cover in a bonus episode.
Yeah, we'll dive more into like the histories and some of like these references that are being made about like Maegor, the doom of Valyria, dragon dreams, all that stuff. I think is good lore for people to be able to have context for around what's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, I loved that because of the way that they decided to do a lack of like an intro. Like, I feel like I was kind of on the edge of my seat wondering, oh, are they going to use the same title theme from Game of Thrones? And then like, no, they didn't. And then we get all the way through the episode, and then that title theme kind of kicks in with the credits. And I just sat there feeling like, I just felt really happy. I was like, oh, we're back to like this world. I'm getting all of those feelings again. I thought it was a solid ending for sure.
Yeah, I think so too. It reminded me of the theme that we heard at the end reminded me of a track from Game of Thrones season 4, I think, called The Children, which is when Arya leaves Westeros and sails to Braavos. Like that, if I recall correctly, that was like a very choral version of the theme song. And we heard I don't think it's the same. I think it's like different, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think we heard that at the end of this episode as well. So, sets up like really... Well, I think the main conflict of the season, which is going to be Rhaenyra versus Daemon. So I'm looking forward to what else is to come. So that's going to bring us to the end of this episode of A Cast of Kings. I want to say, if you're listening, thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. You can find more episodes of this podcast at acastofkings.com. Find us on YouTube at acastofkings.com/YouTube. Find us on TikTok at acastofkings.com/TikTok. And you can support this podcast at decodingtv.com, where you can sign up for ad-free episodes and exclusive bonuses. And also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. So until next week, we'll see you for another episode of House of the Dragon and A Cast of Kings.
Woohoo! Signing off.